Well, about time I came back on with this show, huh? Kind of delayed it, had to delay last week due to, complications on my end. But anyway, hey everyone that's tuning in either now or later in the replay. This is yet another episode of Through Artistic Eyes. I am your host, Christopher D. Casson, artist, photographer, and obviously podcaster that happens to be on the spectrum that went from being recluse to now wanting to, learn more about the world around me instead of holding myself back. So another thing that I and many other people should also start learning about is financing. So here I have Ruben Lowing, who is definitely has quite the resume. And we're gonna and first I wanted to say thank you so much for, being able to spend some time with us to teach us about this kind of thing that should be more common knowledge than it is.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's somebody always I talk about a lot.
Yeah, and we already have a few people popping in. For those that are listening into the audio podcast version, I use StreamYard, so we then sometimes have guests appearing and sometimes they leave their comments and also questions. So just a heads up there. And the first thing I wanted to talk about, just to quickly get through it is, part of your career was being part of the Navy SEALs. So I just wanted to quickly go over, what was your time spending there and how did the experience, change your life and how you applied the lessons towards what you do today? And kind of curious myself because, being on the spectrum, last time I checked, those who are autistics aren't exactly allowed in the military. So I'm always been curious.
Well, I started boxing at a really early age. I started hitting a speed bag was like 7 years old, and I took a class in my senior year of high school. It was sports literature. I'm like, oh, this is cool! I could read Sports Illustrated and get a grade. I can do that anyways, right? Well, we learned a lot more than just that, and one of the topics was pipeline, and I found that if you were in the military and you were good enough, that would be your job. And I, Marine Corps had the boxing team. There was a guy named Jeff McCracken that I used to watch on USA Wide World of Sports. And so I went and knocked on the Marine Corps recruiter's door, and they were out to lunch. And the Navy recruiter said, "Oh, come here, I'll talk to you." And before I knew it, I was signed up for the Navy. He told me I could box in boot camp. He lied. And then
Little bit of a fib there.
I was going through my A school in for like aviation electronics in Millington, Tennessee, and the Marine Corps had a boxing team. I was the only guy in the Navy that was fighting with these guys, sparring with them. And I ended up winning my the gold. I ended up winning the featherweight novice division golden gloves in the city of Memphis in '82. And I got transferred to Pensacola, and I ended up in the same gym as Roy Jones Jr. And he was about 100 pounds, and I was fighting at 125. We were about the same height. And then he kept getting bigger and I didn't. And when I was 20, 16, I was still the same size and he was a lot bigger and hit a lot harder. And I went in the SEAL teams because a Navy diver told me that if I went to the SEAL team, they would send me the Navy box team, which is what I did, but that's the hard way to do it. I joined the military because of I wanted to make a change. I wanted to have an impact in the world. I was really frustrated what was going on in 1979 with the Iran hostage situation, and I felt that I wanted to do my part to get some respect back for our country. And there was enough of the same people that thought the same way that were in the SEAL teams around the same time, and a lot of amazing things happened on my watch. My first deployment was to the Persian Gulf during the Iran-Iraq War. Then my next deployment, I was in Panama 6 months before the Panama invasion. Then I was in the Panama invasion. Then I lived there for 3 years. And then I went to SEAL Team One And I went to Korea right after Kim Jong Il came into power. And then I got out in 96 and I got into the mortgage real estate business. And I, took to that, made a lot of money, helped a lot of people. I started off as a debt management consultant. When I left the military, I was so broke, I couldn't change my mind. Mm-hmm. And I self-educated myself on personal finance and debt management and put the strategies to work for myself. And then I answered ad in the paper as a debt management consultant. And first month, I wrote more business for that company than anybody had done for a year and a half. They were incorporating a mortgage refinance or restructure, a second mortgage or a first mortgage refinance. And they were only wrapping up strategic debt that created the largest margin of savings. And then they would take that amount and put it into a debt roll-up strategy. And then they also incorporate consumer credit counseling and debt settlement strategies, adding gas to the fire, paying everything. They would advertise paying everything off, including your mortgage, in as little as 5 to 10 years without increasing the monthly payment. Mm-hmm. And I wrote more business for them than anybody had done for like a year and a half, and maybe the manager. And every time I showed somebody how to get out of debt, they looked at buying a house. So I got my real estate license. Mm-hmm. And a crystal ball, I couldn't have picked a better time to get in that business when I did. It was 98. And 2001 to 2006, I averaged $200,000 a year, but it just stopped. And then I got a call from some young man. He was 26 years old, had a degree in communications, all excited, and calls me up and, "How's business?" I'm like, "A little slow, isn't everybody?" He goes, "Not ours." And I'm like, "What are you doing?" "Well, that's what I want to show you. We're going to have a broker luncheon tomorrow at noon, and we're going to talk about, you know, what we do and how we help families." And I was like, "Free lunch?" He goes, "Yep, I go, I'm there." And so the first part of it was about, you know, getting the budget together, you know, trimming down at, you know, unnecessary expenses, knocking down your debt. And then it started talking about emergency fund and proper protection and investments. I'm like, "Oh, see, all those people that I'd help get into a house or get into a better mortgage, I knew they needed this kind of help." So I took this young guy on 40 appointments in 1 month, gave him credibility right there with him. And I was looking for referrals from real estate. And that's where I thought the money was. Hmm. And I got about 6 referrals, but that young man, he got a $30,000 commission and got a promotion, and his commission's paid in 4 days. Hmm. And I went, "Oh, what are those licenses?" Then, you know, at that time we were focused on the variable products, variable universal life, variable annuities. And you had to have a securities license. So it took me a while. I didn't get all my licenses until November of 2007. And that's when the whole world fell apart. And
yeah, the 2008, 2009 housing market crash.
Well, it was 2007, 2008. 2009, things started coming back. I started writing some business then. And then my dad died. I went through a divorce. Kind of turned my world upside down. I did other things. I did anti-piracy security in the Indian Ocean. That led me to the drone business. I love that business, but then there was too many challenges with the FAA, and I had to find something, you know, to do while they were trying to figure that out, and got into the LED light business and learned about that and started my own little rep company. But it was feast or famine. And then I came here to the Rio Grande Valley and started providing services to the produce warehouses here in the Rio Grande Valley. There's more produce warehouses in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas than there is in the whole state of California. Huh. And I love the people. I'm well known down here, but I, you know, wasn't making enough money. And I found an office of the same company that was doing financial services in California. They just did things that different. They focused on the financial literacy. They have this campaign, I can see this, educating 30 million families in the next 30 years. teaching workshops on, you know, increasing your cash flow, debt management, emergency fund protection, savings, and wealth, asset accumulation strategies, funding for college and university, retirement planning, utilizing investment vehicles, your health and wealth, and estate preservation, and a whole bunch more.
Yeah.
That got me excited because I was a master training specialist in the military. So training is what I do.
So that's how everything got hooked together right there. Funny how that happens, huh?
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah. So now that we're actually kind of diving into the financial part, because one of the reasons I really wanted to get to this episode is, you know, I always want to have like people on the autistic spectrum to be, you know, as independently as possible. And one of the ways to do that is to also help them out financially, which is kind of a bit of a struggle to various reasons, which I'll get into later. But I also decided to look up information on different parts of financial literacy and came up with a bunch of things, such as 1 in 4 parents reported that they never or just seldom talk to their kids about household finances. So one thing I'll ask, did your parents ever talk to you about financing? And 2, why do you believe parents are so hesitant on having that discussion? Is it because they don't know much themselves, or what's your opinion on that?
Well, that's a very good question. Susie Orman, wrote quite a few books, does a lot of talks, but you know, not a lot of people in the industry like what she has to say, but she has a really good understanding of the psychology of people. And one of the things she said is your earliest money memories affect how you deal with money the rest of your life. And so I got to thinking about that, and it was about 1968. I was about 5 years old. I might have been 4 years old. And my dad and I were watching the Jackie Gleason show on our little black and white TV. And he had the June Taylor dancers kicking up their legs. And I guess my dad, where do you get all those pretty ladies? And my father said he paid for them. And I ran to my bedroom and I grabbed my piggy bank and I jumped up in his lap. And all the tooth fairy money and money I found, you know, in the laundry and behind the couch or in the, you know, backseat of the car, I had $11.22. I can still remember how much it was to this day. And I asked my dad, is that enough to buy a pretty lady? And he says, almost. And then it was about a year later, my dad had saved up his money. My dad used to work for Fisher Body in Lansing, Michigan, building auto parts for GM vehicles, GM. And my mom was in the hospital. I remember him having to save my grandmother. And I remember thinking it was something like cancer, but it was some female problem she had. And dad comes in with a brand new bib overalls, sets me up on his lap and holds up, you know, a wad of bills about that big around and waves in front of my face and says, smell that. Don't ever forget that smell. And to this day, I can pick up the smell of money. But I remember thinking, mom doesn't know he has this much money. And throughout my life, I've always been very open about my finances with my significant other. My mom and my dad used to have major problems because he wouldn't let her, you know what anything was going on. He was very tight with the money. And I've learned that, you know, you've got to budget your, your dinners out or your entertainment, you know, make that part of your plan. And then it's not like, you know, like you and I were talking about, I got my computers in the shop. I'm using my tablet for this because I got a, for, you know, 7:30 this morning, I got an email, opened it up and it was a virus. And it's $180 that I didn't budget for. Right.
Yeah.
You know, so the thing I had my emergency, like I said, you know, having that having that taken care of, it's going to be no problem. But if I didn't have that emergency fund, it would have been a problem.
Yeah.
So the how you know, my dad, you know, I remember one time I got my 401k and it was the top of the .com. And I'm like, you know, what goes up has got to come down. And so I didn't invest in or the NASDAQ funds. I bought Home Depot, I bought Walmart, and I bought Disney. So I called my dad up and I'm like, tell him, he goes, well, you know, Walmart's good. They got good prices and people are going to shop there, especially if there's a recession. And he said, and then Home Depot, people are always fixing up their homes, whether they buy a new house, or getting ready to sell their old house. You know, people are always going to be, you know, going there. But your real buy is Disney. Because the Asians are so heavily vested in entertainment stocks, and now their economies hit the skids, and so they're unloading that. So that's on sale. And I'm like, Dad, do you have cable? Did you learn that? You got Bloomberg? How do you know this kind of stuff? He goes, well, I read the financials. I read the financial page every day. I got to find out, is Russia buying or selling? Do I need to grow corn or do I need to grow wheat? You know, he taught me about the difference between good debt and bad debt. You know, he says, you know, bad debt's like credit cards. The interest rate's so high and the payment's so low, you'll never pay them off. But good debt is like, you know, if I need to buy a piece of equipment like a tractor or a combine, is it smarter for me to work and save to buy that piece of equipment cash, or is inflation going to keep it just as far out of my reach? If that's the case, then it's better for me to finance a piece of equipment, put it to work to make more money to pay the loan off faster. And,
yeah,
you know, he said, you got to think of yourself as being in the egg business and your money's your chickens. You don't want to eat your chickens.
Yeah. Don't put all the eggs in one basket, so to speak.
Yeah. I saw Robert's question about the cryptocurrency, right?
Yeah. And actually, since we're on cryptocurrency, that I wanted to, you know, a lot of people are taking notes on cryptocurrencies, like especially Bitcoin, more recently Dogecoin, which I did invest in, but right before I spiked up. So, hey, made some back. Ethereum, etc., and especially with NFTs utilizing Ethereum for what that does. So where do you see the future of cryptocurrency? You know, should people invest a little in it? Maybe like different compartments with investments or along with it, the stocks?
There's a term that they use for day trading. And it's like catching a falling knife. Okay. And there's, you know, people lag in the market. You know, people that got in early, right, they're reaping the reward right now. But only if they sell it. If they hold on to it, you know, yeah, the value's there, but until they sell it, and then when they do sell it, if they don't do it the right way, they're gonna pay capital gains and taxes out their nose. So, you know, there's a strategy to do that. I kind of stumbled on that actually looking for strategies for real estate investors to reduce their capital gains and taxes. And the same strategy can be used for the cryptocurrencies. And it's common. You know, anybody who's a, you know, investor understands how to do that. The challenge with it is there's no protection. You know, there's no, until there's a, you know, people are buying and it's all supply and demand, so it's going up and up and up and up. But when they sell it, and the government wants it to go up, because when you sell it, you're going to have that bill for capital gains, and they want that money. You know, there's a smart way to do it, and we have those strategies. You know, how, you know, one, if it ever became, it could closely, you know, like your credit card, that's digital currency right there,
yeah.
You know, but it's backed by real dollars. And so until the cryptocurrency is actually attached to something tangible like the dollar or silver or gold, then you got to have, then there's, it's just basically a pyramid scheme is what it is. And that's, you know, it's a Ponzi scheme is what really it is, right?
Well, I've also heard of, you know, stable coins that try to solve that issue being like one coin equals $1 always kind of thing. But I don't know. I'm still kind of new to the space. So I'm just wondering if you ever heard about those stable coins.
Yeah, I mean, until they get the. That's not the part that I don't do a lot with that. I know enough about it to know how to help people liquidate paying the capital gains.
Okay, so let's see. He's got a comment here.
Yeah, you know, you can buy real estate as long as you can turn that money over into dollars, they'll do that.
What was that? Sorry, you were kind of going out there a bit. So you kind of got cut off there.
Oh, Robert, there's some people that are planning to back the currency with land. Okay, but until it's backed by real dollars or gold or something of real value, it's not gonna, even that isn't gonna work. What you got to do is you got to get a solid foundation. And what we teach people, very first thing is you got to get educated.
Yep.
And in these workshops all the time, we teach out of a book. It's called Saving Your Future. There's almost 2 million. We taught it at Harvard Business School, Columbia Business School, to Oracle and the FBI. And when people start learning enough and the light comes on, like, okay, I need to start doing that, start taking advantage of that, then we help them. And, you know, and then they, once they understand it, then it has more value to them. You know, they're not going to in their investment premium. They're, you know, cause it's going to, and then when those value, you know, those accounts start growing, then they really take pride in it. And it takes a life of its own.
So this group, I believe it's called WSD. Could you tell us, like, kind of a brief description of who they are and what they stand for that you're a part of? Since we're going into WSD, that?
There was a guy. He's a Vietnamese refugee. He became a social worker, and he was helping other refugees find jobs and get housing. And he worked hard, but the harder he worked, he couldn't make any more money. And he got into this business, and he started, you know, he was a little short Vietnamese guy, had very broken English. You know, he knew he wasn't going to make it on his looks and his personality. And so what he decided to do was make the information the star, and hence the book. He wrote the book, Saving Your Future. And he wrote some other books talking about his struggle and what happened. And that he found that once people, you know, you're never going to be free until you're financially free. On this card, it's on the top here. You can't hardly read it, but it's in cursive. It says, you know, is your money controlling you, or do you control your money? And that's a very good question, and they have to think about it. You know, there's a lot of people that make good money, but if they stop working, that money stops coming in. And until you get that money to start making, once your money makes more money than you do working, then you can retire.
Yeah, don't work for the money, make the money work for you kind of thing.
That's exactly right. And so he broke it down and to having the right financial foundation and creating the right priorities. And that's what it takes. And some people get in discipline. They resist that.
So.
Yeah, Robert, you know more about cryptocurrency than I do. I'm not a gambler. I'm not somebody you'd want to get advice from playing shooting craps or playing poker either.
Yeah, I sometimes view cryptocurrency almost like the Wild West version of like stocks kind of thing. So it's kind of like a really huge risk at the moment, but with huge risks, there's also huge rewards, but it could also just as easily backfire on you.
The challenge is you got to spend so much of your time focused on it, because what's going to happen?
Yeah.
If you have to go to work, right?
Yeah, especially since
there's a certain investment hierarchy pyramid. Like 50% of your money needs to be in safe investments. Something, whether it's CDs, bonds,
IRAs, Roth IRAs.
Well, see, IRA, all that is that's an envelope of tax protection. It stands for individual retirement account. Okay, so what's in it is what really makes it work. So what's in it is something that's got, your money, it may not grow really fast, but your money's not going anywhere. Okay. And then 40%, they recommend being in something maybe a little more speculative, real estate, the little more aggressive real estate, individual stocks, mutual funds, variable contracts. Okay. And then only like 10% of your portfolio should be in the cryptocurrency, the oil and gas, commodities, Forex, okay? But what happens is, so if you lose 10%, it's 10%. It's like taking your finger in a glass of water and taking it out. If you hit an oil well, you strike a gusher, right? Well, then what you need to do is you need to reallocate the gain in that same structure so you keep your money.
Yeah, because I remember one story where someone just invest, I'm trying to remember what it was. I'm not sure if it was cryptocurrency or what was it, but they decided to invest their entire life savings into it, and unfortunately it busted, and then they lost everything. It actually might have been the housing crisis, actually, in 2008, but yeah.
I'll tell you a story. I had all this money, and I knew I could see the market was going, right? I had dabbled in boxing promotions, and I had a great success my first time out. And I got approached by somebody who had great contacts for venues and for fighters, but he didn't have TV, and I was trying to help him get television. And I found a producer, but the guy who had kind of a harebrained idea that I knew wasn't going to work. And so I came up with this scheme of interactive boxing where the audience actually votes on, like, American Idol. The audience has weight in the scoring. And so the producer liked it, and we did it, and I paid for it. And long story short, $55,000 later, I found out that producer was eating my money instead of finishing the post-production. Then I found another producer, and I only had to pay him $15,000, but he put that fight in the can and sold it three times in Brazil and in South Korea, and I didn't get a dime of that. And then I went to talk to Mark Ratner in Las Vegas. At the time, he was the Nevada State Athletic Commissioner. I told him my concept. He said, the officials won't let you do it. They don't trust the fans. It won't happen. And bam, I was out everything. My whole concept. And so I learned, it's that when you roll the dice, you got to make sure you can afford to lose it.
Yeah.
That was a really tough lesson.
Yeah. That's kind of how I thought about diving into cryptocurrency, just put in whatever amount you are ready to actually lose, just in case.
Yeah, and that's why that asset allocation hierarchy, pyramid, whatever you want to call it, that's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah, so anyway, you know, since we're talking about different points of financial literacy right there with how we portioned everything, what are some basic financial tips that you think more people should know yet for some reason don't?
Commit to your saving. Save at least 10%. You know, you should tie 10%. You should save 10%. You need to just review your finances probably every quarter or every month. You know, I had with my own self, I realized I was putting some money out in some storage. I was paying too much for my phone and my internet, and I cut those away, and I was able to free up some money and start saving it. And it, without any effort, and I had done that before, and it happens to do that with a lot of people. I can sit down with people and I basically tell them, if I can help you free up some money, would you invest it with me? You know, so basically you help them start off without negatively affecting their lifestyle. You actually put them in a better position without negatively affecting their lifestyle.
Yeah, so basically, what's his name? I can't believe I'm forgetting the name. Warren Buffett, because I remember he bought his house way back in the 1950s, still has the exact same car that he did way back when, and that's because, you know, if it still works, why bother to keep always going for the latest and greatest trend or whatever? Instead, just save that money for in future investments and whatnot, you know?
Well, it's kind of like that. My dad's, you know, the, you know, way of looking at good debt and bad debt. When you look at cars, you know, when you've had that old, you got that old car that you're driving around, and once the point you get to the point where the repairs are equal to what a payment on a new car is, it might make sense to get a new car that you can depend on. You know, so you got to make that determination. You know, if you have a newer, more modern car, better gas mileage, more reliable, better, more peace of mind, it'll actually give you more confidence. And with your confidence, you become more productive. You become more attractive toward people and money.
Okay. So yeah, Robert is really going, continuing on with the conversation with cryptocurrencies about, you know, he's mentioned that there are many decentralized services that are competing for attention and is open to many more than the traditional banking system. So, and that Henry Ford apparently said that if the whole country suddenly completely understood the monetary system, there would be a revolution before the next dawn.
Huh. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the beginning of 2020, there was the crisis in the repo market. Yeah. And what that was, repo stands for repurchase operations. And there's big banks like Chase and Barclays that they loan money overnight to the smaller banks because they have to have a certain reserve requirement. And if they don't have it, they borrow it from these bigger banks. And they just stopped. And I thought it was because there was leftover toxic mortgage assets from 2008. Well, those have pretty much been diluted. Those homes have been resold and refinanced, and there's not very many of those left. What it was China decided not to buy internal combustion engine automobiles anymore. And that's caused the US, the Japanese, and the German auto makers to start totally shifting their focus manufacturing electric cars, competing with Tesla. And the banks got concerned that most of these treasuries from these smaller banks were used car loans. And they were worried that people were going to realize that their cars weren't worth as much as they owed. And they would you know, park them along the side of the highway, put their keys up over the visor, and walk away from them like they did their houses in 2008. And that's when the Fed had to jump in and basically take the place of the bigger banks in the repo market. And that caused the stock market to take off because these companies started losing confidence in the banking system. And so they started buying up their own stock, because if they have stock, then they can get capital. They can either sell the stock or borrow against the stock, and they don't have to be dependent on loans. And way back in like 2009, there's a economist, his name is Paul Dietrich. And he was talking about, he's still in Foxhall Capital. He was the chairman of Foxhall Capital. He was talking about how that because of 2008 and what happened in the banking system, that advisors for hedge funds and retirement funds and insurance companies were going to look at things differently. You know, they're always going to look at they got a smart CEO, they got a smart board of advisors to make good decisions. Are they marketing to the emerging market? Do they have a good supply chain management? But the main thing they were looking for was low debt and lots of capital, because they didn't want to be putting the money into accounts that were companies that were too dependent on the banking system, because if the bank cuts that credit off, that company's not going under. And so that is what has happened. But it got put gas on the fire when they made then that happen with the repo market. So now, you know, companies started buying up their own stock like crazy, inflating the stock market because of the fear of what's going on in the banking world. So that's why, you know, we've got a runaway stock market.
Yeah, I was wondering about that actually, but yeah, that dog is kind of going berserk right at the moment. You know how it is. There's always some sort of interruption, but anyway, I've also learned, you know, from me looking up facts that over 40% of Americans have less than $10,000 saved when they retire, and apparently 48% of them just simply don't care at all. And you know, why, in your opinion, should they start caring? You know, how do you even get started with saving up? I know you went into the whole 10% save over time, but is there anything else you would like to add to that?
You've got to make it a priority. And I'll tell you what, when you get to the point when you start getting older and your knees start bothering you and your shoulders start bothering you and you're just fed up with the rat race, that's when you're like, okay, I need to do something. I need to take control and figure out what I got to do, whether it's starting a company or starting a business or, you know, start socking that money away and investing it. So you get to that point where your money makes more money than you do. And that's when you can retire. It's not, you know, if you had $1 million, what's his name? He's from Louisiana. Grant Cardone. Says, you know, people got to stop listening to millionaires. They need to listen to multimillionaires and billionaires, because if you only had $1 million and you're drawing $45,000 a year in income off that $1 million, you will run out of money in 22 years. How old are you going to be in 22 years? What are you going to do then? Okay.
Yeah.
And until people have that realization that job's not going to keep coming, you know, they get downsized, or they get their job gets replaced by automation or
the pandemic last year that caused all kind of
ruckus. Yeah. You know, what was crazy about our business grew like it's never grown before. They had that campaign of 30 million in 30 years. They started off with took them from 2015 to 2020 to educate 1 million families in financial literacy. It happened July of 2020. Since July of 2020, they've already educated over 450,000 people. All right. So that, you know, it's people are during these crises, people start paying more attention. They understand that they, you know, it's up to them.
Right. Yeah, and you know, especially with all this talk of hyperinflation, and you know, some people even struggling to even buy a home with the prices going up and up and up. And so during those times, it could be really a struggle to even think of saving up for anything, really. So what would be the good steps for them when they're in such a struggling situation, like kind of right now, especially with the middle class that's been shrinking for a while now, and especially for autistics, who 8% of people on the autistic spectrum are actually either under or unemployed, and that's part of our own struggles.
Well, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, right? You know, if I knew then what I know now, my first house would have been a 2-unit or a 4-unit, and I would have lived in one unit and rented the other 3 out. I would have gotten paid to live in my house. Hmm. That's, you know, I knew a young guy. He was he didn't make a lot of money on his job. He was a security guard at a hospital, but he was really into martial arts and he liked to train. And he found a HUD home. It was a fixer upper, and he got a FHA loan and bought the house and fixed it up. And then he refinanced out of it, and he had a crazy amount of equity in that house. And what he did is he got a low interest line of credit, revolving line of credit. And whenever he find another opportunity, invest, you know, property that was in distress, he would take from that line of credit, put the down payment and closing costs, fix that place up and sell it, and then replenish the line of credit and then put the other money in his account. And he made way more money doing that than he did on his job, but he kept his job because it allowed him to have the time to do that with the properties and also train in martial arts.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm kind of in those stages. You know, right now I have like one of those third shift overnight jobs, but with the, I don't know, it just isn't working for me, particularly because I've just been getting a lack of sleep trying to do everything. And unfortunately it's having a negative effect on my health, which again, hospital bills, self-explanatory, but yeah, you know, so I'm just, you know, and it's just, it could still be a bit of a struggle even for doing something like getting a day job where either, well, it could be a multiple things just to kind of go over quickly on what autistics deal with. You know, sometimes it deals with sometimes even saying not being hired, sometimes even because maybe some people have this stereotype of autism and, you know, those autistic tantrums and whatnot in their heads, and they don't want to deal with that. Or sometimes they do get the job, but it will still struggle to get through those interviews. And sometimes there's bullying at the workplace, and sometimes there's just all the other things that kind of set off with the sensory overload, which is why originally I did not want to get a job that's during the day, because I was kind of worried at first about how I would actually be able to handle it. So just to kind of give you an idea of, you know, what it's like for an autistic with just dealing with that kind of struggle, you know. But, you know, you just still have to push forward. And, you know, I've been...
When I look at you, you've got... a lot of talent when it comes to the photography and the creativeness, and that's worth something. The challenge yeah. with, I had a, my first wife had a degree in commercial design and graphics, and she was amazing. She was phenomenal. Right. But she never really used it much. I mean, she had a business where she would frame pictures, and she had all these wealthy clients that lived in the Coronado Caves. And it was fascinating. I'd go with her on an appointment, and her and this the lady of the house, they would look at this blank wall, and be talking about the artwork as if it was hanging there with the match and the frames that, you know, my wife was had in mind for them. And it was, that was golden what she did, but she spent all of her time cutting the glass and cutting the mats, screwing the frames together, where she could have had, you know, a high school student do that. You know, paid him minimum wage to do that. And she could have been out there hustling up more business. And in your case, yeah, you've got this podcast. I would showcase your, I would get permission from all your customers, and I would show slides of all the pictures you're taking. I would market myself like crazy. I would have realtors on here that you were working with, and, you know, and as you're, and showing pictures of the houses that they're selling, markets you and them, and they will market you more.
Well, it depends on what my target audience is, but that's a whole different conversation altogether almost. But yeah, true. But
I know what I would do if I were you. You know, you've actually got a presence. You've got a following. And that's why I'm on the show with you. You know, I have my license in Indiana.
Yeah.
So just get out there.
Yeah, and that's part of it, just needing those connections. So, you know, talking about, you know, the mine's trying to freeze. I mean, audience. Yeah, you know, part of the audience of this podcast has been mainly the United States, but, you know, there have been viewers from different regions outside of the States. With right now, my current biggest being in Europe, and, you know, even a little bit here and there in Australia, and even like South America and Brazil, for instance. So for those trying to learn financial literacy outside of the States and getting started with setting themselves up for a better financial future where they are, you know, just where to even start with that for them? Is it still applicable, the same thing, depending on the laws in their country, or how could they get started? And I know that's kind of a rather large question, yeah, so let's just focus on Europe for now.
So the group I'm affiliated with, I can do business in all the United States and every province of Canada. Now, there is an extension of our company that's worldwide, and it's, you know, the bigger pins, they are doing the worldwide part of it. And I'll see what I can find on that, because it's, they're going worldwide with this financial literacy. Every country's different when it comes to their taxation strategies and you know, the trust strategies and all of that is different. But when you figure it out, you can figure, you know, you can, you know, it, the government has these laws, they steer you to go a certain way. Okay. So if you realize, you know, like IRS code 7702 alpha, if you have money in an insurance contract, it's got to be after tax money, money you've already paid the taxes on, in, it'll grow tax deferred, so it grows faster. And when you take it out, as on a wash loan. So let's say you want $60,000 a year to live on in retirement, and you got $1 million policy getting 5%. You know, you take 5%, they take 5% out of your policy, and they'll credit you 2.3%. And then the insurance company puts it in their general account. And when they take it out of their general account to pay you, they pay it to you as a loan, and they charge you 2.3%. So it's a wash. But that's how you get out of not paying taxes on that money. And it's approved, and it's been, you know,
it's been around for a while, and
it's not going to change. And so why are they doing that? Why are they doing that? Because they want you to get life insurance. They want, when something happens to the breadwinner, that the government's not taking care of his family. That's why they do that. Hmm. And so they on purpose.
Yeah, I'm just reading Robert's next comment. Once you know, just you know, remember to find an accountant that makes it their personal challenge to find every single thing in the tax code that is buried there for those that dig deep to reward their efforts.
Hmm. Well, yeah, and that's for the tax year right now. They don't look down the road. Very few do, and you've got to do that for yourself. And you got to figure out what it is you have to do to keep your tax profile down, so you're not paying a whole bunch of taxes every year, but also that you have enough so you can buy a house. You have enough so you can start saving for retirement in a vehicle that's not going to tax you to death when you retire, like the qualified plans, IRAs, 401ks, SEPs, you know, different strategies. They're qualified by the IRS for the tax deduction on the contribution and the tax deferred growth, but they're fully taxed at your regular income when you take that money out.
Yeah, and another response from Robert: I have read your tax code and I am Canadian, just to get the facts versus what I'm hearing in the media.
Right. I mean, the trust strategies, I found out those are those same trust strategies, whether you're using them for real estate or cryptocurrency, are also available to Canadians.
Okay. So we're kind of getting down to the wire here, actually. I did mention IRAs and Roth IRAs, and I know there is a difference between something that's Roth and something that's just, you know, regular. So could you quickly go over what the difference is, just for, as a almost a final question?
Good question. All right. The limit on a Roth IRA is $6,000, all right? Or unless you're over 55, then you can get $65,000 or $7,000 to catch up, okay? Mm. And it's tax after tax dollars. It grows tax deferred, and you don't pay tax on it when you take it out. And it can be whatever you want in it. It can be mutual funds. It can be individual stocks, whatever it is within that envelope of legal protection. The difference between a regular IRA is you get a tax deduction on the contribution. It's the same limit, $6,000. The it grows tax deferred, but when you take it out, you know, it's kind of like the difference choosing being a farmer. Do I pay tax on the seed or do I pay tax on the harvest? Which are you going to pay more? You're probably going to pay more tax on the harvest. So it might be smarter to pay tax on the seed, all right, and then let that grow tax deferred so it grows faster and you'll get tax advantage when you take it out. Roth, there's limits, and it's better when you start when you're young.
As young as possible, but, you know, or just to get started, period.
Right. The younger you are, the better it is.
And I know that might defer those that might be watching this in a much older generation, but, you know, it's better to just start than to just sit on your hands and just let the opportunity pass you by.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I ask people all the time, you know, what's the limit on a 401k? Do you know?
Actually, I don't, because I'm financially illiterate.
It's 15% of your income. Or $17,000 a year, whichever's less. There's a SEP IRA, which is $56,000 a year. In a SEP IRA, you got to be self-employed or 1099, right? And then there is a what do they call it? A defined benefit plan where you can up to 100% of your income up to 200 and $50,000 a year. It used to be $280,000, and I don't know what when that ratcheted back. But those are all, you know, things that, you know, vehicles for investing. But those are all qualified. That means you're going to get a tax deduction on the contribution. But when you take that money out, you're going to pay tax on that. It's going to go tax deferred, but you're going to pay tax on that money when you take it out.
Hmm.
So when you know all the limits and you put it all together, you can map out a pretty good plan. You know, you give yourself more time in your life insurance while you're putting in the qualified plans with your maxing out your 401k or your IRA. And then you start taking the money from that first, right? And then, or you get enough income stream from the from your policy to cover what you pay in taxes in your qualified plan. So there's all different strategies that you can use. You need to sit down with somebody and have them look at the whole big picture for you and help you figure it out. And that's what I do.
Yeah, and you know, since we're getting down to the wire, and you know, I'm sure some people would like to ask you questions. How can they contact you and just learn more about what you do and what was the WSB, I believe it was that.
Yeah, I have a website, RubenLowing.com. My email, you got that, Ruben.Lowing@gmail.com, and then my number is 956-255-0061, and it's on my website.
Okay. And I just want to go over one more comment here. He said, on the path with similar outcome, those legal bulletins that are free to subscribe for anyone in business that may have to deal with legal issues in the future, reading these did comfort me greatly. Once you learn the truth of what is going on in the courts, how decisions are reached, it's nothing like what you read in the newspaper. Okay, so
yeah, Robert, you focus on, if you had all the right information, you might be dangerous. You know, got to get you plugged in the right information and get let that sink in that gray matter and let you reach get out there in your market. Yeah, we need to talk about that. I am going to be tonight at 7 o'clock. We're going to be on a presentation. I will post the Zoom information on my Facebook page. Right now, my computer's in the shop, but I can still do it on my tablet. I can get on my tablet and I can post it on.
Let's see. Robert used to have a habit of thinking too much and always to a negative for me conclusion.
Well, thinking's good. You just got to make sure you got the right information.
Yeah, you just need to overthink on the right information instead of the negative stuff. See, learning how not to think has been a great blessing.
You know, when I was in SEAL training, my roommate and swim buddy, we were equal swimming. He was a faster runner than me. I could always beat him on the obstacle course, and he just like, how do you? He's like, I was cheating. I'm like, dude, you try to manipulate every obstacle. I just throw myself over it. And that's kind of how I go through life.
That's a good way to look at it. You see, and he says now, and Robert said, now I can hear and follow what's in my heart. Since he decided to learn not to think as much, I'm guessing less focus on the thoughts and being able to focus more on what's in here.
Well, that subconscious mind is always going to put that little doubt in your brain, and you got to learn that it's there to protect you, and you just have to discern whether, okay, is it what's it really protecting? You know, if I do something and fail, am I going to be worse off than if I stay where I'm at? And if you're not, then it may as well do something, may as well go after it.
Yeah. So basically just treat your mind kind of like a person with a second opinion, and you could just take it in or just chuck it out the window if you don't agree with it.
Subconscious mind, he's pretty harsh. Shut up! I wasn't talking to you.
Yeah.
Quit butting in. So I had to learn to talk about subconscious mind. It's like, okay, you've done some great things, you know, you've done some impressive things. We want to do more, but you gotta calm down and just be quiet. I think this through. And that works.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's commenting again saying, yes, so I could hear my inner voice. After all, we hear the kingdom of heaven is within each of us.
Amen, Robert.
Amen. Trying to think of how the I'm just overthinking of how a Buddhist would respond to that in a similar manner, but anyway. And he's continuing, it had much to do with what is in my subconscious mind. I put a whole lot of high quality knowledge in there over the years. Good.
Yeah, that's all banked in there. You can use it. You just gotta learn to sort it out and give the right priority. That's something that's what happens is like there are things like right now, I got involved with this non for profit. And we just registered here in Texas, and it's Enviro Project International, or Enviro Project Test in Texas, or Enviro Community Inc. And I had to figure out about what their mission statement was. In Florida, they have a facility to house people that have been displaced from their homes from natural disasters. A hurricane took out their home, and they need a place to live while they're getting it repaired or getting it replaced or whatever. And then they also build energy sustainable communities, solar powered homes with also organic gardens and hydroponics to provide the sustainable agriculture and food. But they also are working with an employment agency that hires veterans to build these communities or build these shelters or, you know, do this work. And then they have a technology for this is really funny. Hemp products. And I knew nothing about this kind of stuff, right? And so I'm on a call. They got me on with the group in Australia. They got like 500 acres, 400 acres is jungle, 100 acres is actually agriculture. And they grow and the plants in a spiral because it's similar to the, you know, the way it's the seeds are in the plants, the melons or whatever. And the lady's talking about how she's walking through and she can feel this positive energy from the plants. And I'm like, first I'm like, cuckoo. But then I'm thinking, you know, I know from my work in the drone industry in agriculture that plants that are in distress put out a negative signal and the bugs are attracted to that. So maybe they do put out positive signals. And then they started talking about this hempcrete. And it's actually stronger composite material than actual cement, and it takes 1/10 of the concrete. And with this whole housing, you know, the housing materials going up, you know, concrete's getting real expensive, and wood is getting real expensive. And then the hemp composites are stronger than fiberglass. And it's every, you know, every 6 months they can grow another harvest, right? And
yeah.
And I realized that I started looking into it. In the produce industry, the big problem is pathogens like Listeria. Listeria will kill you. It comes and it gets transferred by the wooden pallets. And they put the wooden pallets in the trucks, and then the trucks, they put them on your cement floor, which is just hard dirt. It gets in your building. And if you don't get rid of it, it'll take over your building. If it gets in the wood, you got to burn that building down. Most of these new warehouses, they have composite trusses and studs, and I'm like, oh wow, what if they made hemp composite pallets that are, you know, resistant to the pathogens and hemp based studs and rafters, right? So now I know somebody who's land that wants to was wanting to grow marijuana, but they don't let you do that in Texas, so we're going to talk to them about growing hemp. And then we got these people that have got years of manufacturing experience. They sold their company. They got all kinds of money. And there's all kinds of buildings in Westlaco, Texas that are empty. And they're given incentives, 10% to this on the sale or the lease of it, to get businesses in there to start hiring people. And so we're going to have this conversation. And this all just happened like that, right? Just like that. So, yeah. And I'm talking to you about you getting, start talking to these realtors that you're doing the photography for and show off their homes on your photography.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. My issue right now is just getting them to even accept in the first place, because they either say we don't need anything right now because of the way the housing market is, or they have their own teams that they depend on, and they just don't want any outsider, basically. But anyway, we're kind of getting down to the actually 6 minutes over when we should have closed by now, but you know, I just want to get to one comment. Yeah, I appreciate you coming on too. And I just want to hear one more time from Robert, because he's been such a great commenter here and guest. With 27 years of paying 10% of the gross pay away in the private pension plan, he was supposed to run a few years more, but it concluded outside of his control. So I don't know, maybe you should shoot Ruben a message here. Again, the contact information is right below with the email ruben.lowing@gmail.com. That's ruben.lowing.com. Gmail.com. Yeah.
I used to hate how the kids, people remember it.
Yeah. And of course, same thing with RubenLowing.com, and just being able to contact him to learn more about this, and you know how he, and even learn more about how WSB can help you along with getting started on that road of financial literacy. So, thank you again so much, Ruben, for taking the time to be on this episode to teach us more about the financial world.
Well, I hope you learned something. I hope I made sense to people.
Well, if they have any questions, they have the contact info at the very least. And who knows, maybe just have you back on again for another topic on financing as well. Maybe even a panel, who knows?
Oh, that might be fun.
Yeah, that could be fun. So, let's see. I'm just loving reading Robert's comments here. So... I am in touch with Ruben. Is he who revealed to me that it is my duty to become wealthy to better spread my message. Good.
There you go.
There you go. So already you got a... of course, I have a brain freeze or a brain fart right now. But anyway, thank you guys.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, always at the wrong time with me. But anyway, thank you guys so much for joining. Today's episode of Through Artistic Eyes. Again, I am your host, Christopher D. Casson, also sometimes called the Artistic Guru by some people, especially a certain bald Avenger that we both know, but that's another story for another day. So anyway, take care, everyone, and have a great night, and see you next time.
Thank you again. Thank you, Ben, Christopher. All right.